6 p.m., we'll call the meeting order. I'll call for a moment of silence, please. We all stand, pledge of allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Have roll call, please.
Johnny Hopkins?
Here.
Here.
Bonnie Hyman? Here.
Robinson,
here.
Clark Hoffner,
here.
Paul
Greeno, here.
Councilmember Ken Oppenberg has requested to be excused tonight.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Passes 7-0. Next we have 6-0. Correct. Thank you. Recognition and awards. Our next item on the agenda. And we have a Blaine Builder Award for Mr. Walt DeCoin. Mr. DeCoin, could you step forward, please? Oh, where are you? You got to get in there for the picture. So we got to get turned around here. Look at the picture. Walt grew up in Blaine and graduated from the Blaine High School in 1957. He joined the Navy in 1960 and retired from the Navy and returned to Blaine with his wife Sharon in 1982. To continue to raise a family who also graduated from Blaine. He has served on the community and senior center board for over 7 years. He has been a driving force behind the pancake breakfast held each month, which provide funding for the center as well as a great place for the community to gather. On the 4th of July, the pancake breakfast serves over 400 people, thanks to a great volunteer crew of cooks, servers, and kitchen help. And have a great time due to the friendly atmosphere created by Walt. In addition, he is behind the scenes for many other fundraisers for the center, such as the recent giant rummage sale, which raised $2,000 for the center. Walt says he's enjoying volunteering at the center because it makes him feel good. When he isn't volunteering, he loves to go snowshoeing and hiking. Snowshoeing is probably not so good at this time of year.
Nice.
I just like to say that all these fantastic people here, any of them people could be up here, okay? How I got this, I have no idea, but I'll kill the person when I find out. Really, the thing is, like I say, these people out here, this is a group that, I'll tell you what, the best group I've ever been around in my life. We have fun together. When there's work to do, we work. When there's fun to have, we have fun. And it's just a great time.
Well, it's great. You did a great job, and we appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, we're
Thanks, Walt. Thank you.
You too.
You guys. Oh, no, this city is.
It's, I know.
We all know that.
You're great. We appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, our audience disappeared pretty quickly.
You guys! I heard an ugly rumor.
Jason, we should have Jason on first. He could have had some voters.
Yeah.
Could have impressed the voters.
I think you're right. Yeah.
We did it wrong. I was thinking of doing that.
Yeah, you should have listened to me.
I know.
Okay. Hey, John.
Okay, the next item on our agenda is audience participation.
Yeah.
And as the mayor, I'd like to make a proclamation. Whereas the Seafarers Memorial at Blaine Harbor was established in 1984 to promote community awareness and memory of fishers and other sailors who departed, Whatcom County safe harbors and were lost at sea. And whereas the community of Blaine, Washington continues in its concern of the safety and welfare of its seagoing ships and their crews, and whereas the fisher's life is burdened with hazards and difficulties unknown to most of us, and whereas strength and courage are basic requirements for anyone who chooses to work on the high seas, battling the elements in order to harvest nature's bounty, and whereas the men and women who work on boats, living between God and sea, and never certain which will claim them first, are deserving of our respect and our gratitude. And whereas, when fishers do lose their lives, their deaths impact the tightly knit fabric of this and all communities. And whereas the citizens who constitute a Blaine Community Chamber of Commerce Committee dedicated to preserving, enhancement, and promotion of the Seafarers Memorial have planned a service for the blessing of the fleet at the Blaine Harbor. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the community of Blaine and I, Harry Robinson, Mayor of the City of Blaine, Washington, extend our heart-filled thoughts and prayers to the families and friends of the men and women claimed by the sea, and wish the entire commercial fishing fleet a safe and prosperous season, and pray that all fishing men and women will return safely home to their loved ones, and I do hereby proclaim May the 6th, 2012, as Blessing of the Fleet Day. Signed this 23rd day of April 2012.
Give it to Gary.
Gary,
Dunstan. Gary, come on up.
Gary. Gary, if I could present that to you.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
And once again, everybody certainly invited to attend. I would invite you to attend to read this at the Blessing of the Fleet if you can do it.
Really?
If not, maybe someone else can make it. I know Charlie's been there.
Charlie's been there before, yes.
He's been there a number of times, and it's much appreciated.
Okay.
The other thing that the Fisherman's Memorial Committee has done, our main function, of course, is the blessing of the fleet and recognizing all the people we've lost. But this year we established a $500 scholarship fund at the school in conjunction with Blaine High School. And we're going to try to continue that for a few years. We do get a fair amount of money that's donated when people pass away. And so we've been trying to figure out what to do with it. We came up with that idea, and I think it's a great idea. And it's going to start here. It's starting this spring. In fact, next week, I think we're going to go over some applications. The only criteria that we put on that, well, not the only, but one of the criteria was that they somehow be connected to the fishing business. We would like to get it back to the fishing community in that way. And so, and there are an awful lot of kids that go to school in Blaine that are connected to the fishing business. So I think it's going to be a great thing. So again, I invite all of you to attend that. And thank you very much for this again. And
you're more than welcome. Look forward to you on the 6th.
Okay. And I'll keep this so if you can make it. If you can't make it, we'll give it to someone else or I'll read it myself. But if you can, I'll keep it.
We'll have someone from here, I'm sure.
So that's the May the 6th at 1:30.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Was there any sign-up comments? Sign-up sheet?
He said 1:30, didn't he?
Yeah, 1:30. On the 6th. Yeah.
Blessing of the Fleet. It's in that community room at the harbor.
Yeah.
And we don't have anybody.
Okay. Okay.
That's a Sunday.
Thank you, Sherry.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's always on a Sunday.
Next, we're very, very fortunate to have our representative in Washington, Olympia, Washington State, our representative, Mr. Jason Overstreet, who's going to give us a legislative update. Thank you, Jason, for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
We certainly appreciate all the work that you're doing on our behalf, and we really appreciate you being here tonight to give us an update.
Thank you very much. Jason Overstreet, I live about six blocks south here, so not far, you know where to find me. State Representative from the 42nd District, thank you, Mr. Mayor, for having me, and how is that new position treating you?
It's good.
Good, good. And the only disappointment that I have tonight is that my wife wasn't here with me because those Saturday morning pancake feeds, she is probably the biggest fan in town because that is a morning off for her. She loves it. She loves bringing the kids. So, again, thanks for having me. Well, we just finished, the legislature just finished its sixth special session since 2010. And if you were following the news, the last day of the sixth special session was a 23-hour grind. We showed up at about, I think we started that morning at 9 o'clock and we ended 7:30 the next morning. And no one left the building. It was a grinder. So I'm recovered at this point, but it was long. Well, I just wanted to give you a quick, just sort of a flyover, and you can ask me questions at the end, or I could follow up with anything you may have over email or a phone call. But the supplemental budget, the second year of the 2-year budget, ended was settled at about a $31.1 billion budget. And what I'm particularly concerned with and want to really bring your attention to is that the reserve part of that budget. So the money runs out, what do we do for the quote rainy day fund? It ended technically at about $319 million. And to put that into the context of last year's budget, when it was initially signed, we had a reserve of $745 million. Now there's more. That $319 million in reserve is only that big because of, and I'm sure you guys are familiar, the sales tax shift, the way that the state changed the way that it looks at sales tax. So what I'm telling you is that $319 million reserve is more like $80 million. So with the slightest hiccup, that state budget is out of whack again, and we could be looking at another special session. So just keep your eye on that reserve and what the next revenue forecast says, and I believe that's June 20th. So that House Bill 2822 was, I'm sure Gary, staff, I'm sure council is familiar. It changed the way the state looks at sales tax collection. So instead of on a daily basis, it looked at it at the end of the month. Well, that gives you a bigger number in your general fund, which the majority of the legislature chose to look at as an ending fund balance. Can't spend it. And apparently, we're told that it won't affect local municipalities' sales tax reimbursement. And what the bill actually says is that if that sales tax loses any interest because of the way it's recalculated, it'll be repaid through the general fund. So I hope that's the way it works out. I'm not holding my breath. And then another point you folks would be particularly interested in is the local government liquor revenue distributions, how that changes. And I've received multiple calls on that, especially from the mayors and the police chiefs. The bottom line is that under I-83, the way that language was written, and that was the initiative that privatized the liquor sales, local governments will receive the same liquor profit distribution that they received last year plus $10 million. And that's the way the initiative was written. So last year being your baseline plus $10 million. What you're going to see disappear this year is the 70-30 excise tax split. All of it's going to the state general fund. So the state said, you know what, we understand you guys are having hard times, but so are we. We're keeping that portion. And then beginning in calendar year 2014, local governments will continue to receive the liquor excise tax distributions less $10 million that will be kept in the general fund. So the structure's changing a bit, and it's not exactly fair or equitable to local governments. One of the bigger successes and saves was public safety, and I definitely heard from Sheriff Alfo, I heard from all of the police chiefs, but there's historically an agreement that the state helps to pay for the Criminal Justice Training Commission, essentially in that academy, to send people down. We received multiple calls from the police chief saying, hey, don't do that to us. Do not do that to us, because it's going to hamstring their ability not only to hire them, but to send people down to get trained. That essentially was replaced and didn't follow through, which is a good thing. So on the reform side, there were really three big pieces of reform. One was a constitutional debt limit reform, and it takes the constitutional debt limit from 9% down to 8% by 2034. It does that by stair-stepping over time. And right now what we have is, and I don't have it in here, I believe it's 7.5% now, but it's in statute. So what this does is it sends this constitutional amendment to the voters for an up or down vote. And instead of that limit being in statute, which means a simple majority can change it any time there's a great project that needs to be done, it establishes that limit at 9 in the Constitution so that it just over time that number can't be played with. It also smooths the way that the state and the legislature operates its capital budget so that in times like this, versus times that are boom time, it's going to be more of an even growth, whereas in boom times, we all know budgets skyrocket, and in bad times, those budgets fall again, and everyone screaming and scraping for those same dollars. There was also pension reform for the PERS and TERS system, and this is for new members only, and that's a really important point, because pensions are a contractual obligation, and changing them looking back just simply isn't equitable. It's just not right. So this changed it moving forward. It's an estimated $1.3 billion over 25 years. It's technically a pretty small, I think, savings for 25 years, 1.3, but it's a start in the right direction. And essentially what that does is it addresses the early retire portion of those systems' retirement. And after 30 years, you can retire early, but with a 5% reduction for each year before age 65. And again, that's for new hires only. So if you decide to hire on with the state or with the school district, you're gonna know that up front. You're gonna have that choice to make. And there's also a four-year balanced budget bill that said, you know, instead of looking right in front of our face and crafting a biennial budget right in front of our face with those numbers, we're going to project out. Now, that is definitely an imperfect science. We all know how projections have gone the last few years, right? Especially our economic forecasts at the state level. But again, it's intended to smooth that and say, look, does it balance in the next 2 years? Not only does it balance in the next 2 years, but does it balance over the next 4 years? To again try to eliminate these high highs and these low lows, and back to the six special sessions that I talked about earlier, to try to eliminate that. Like I said when I started, my biggest concern is the reserves. Are they really there? And they're not really there. And depending on who you talk to, based on the McCleary decision as far as it relates to education and a couple of other bills, a couple of other issues at the state level, we're already looking at possible $1.5 billion deficit again, the deficit being the difference between what the state is slated to spend and what the economic revenue forecast is saying that we have to spend. So already we're back in that red territory technically based on who you talk to, and so we're going to be back there again saying how do we pare down these projected spending increases to create a sustainable budget moving forward. That having been said, the state general fund is growing in this biennium by about 7% or $2 billion. So the state is definitely growing. The general fund is seeing healthy growth actually at $2 billion. It's just not enough to cover for all of those wants that have been tacked on over time. So that's what we talk about when we talk about those deficits. Again, I thank you for having me, and Mr. Mayor, I certainly hope you appreciate that new position. And while you may appreciate me, trust me, I think about this council and my 5 years here and my experience, and I think about you. And I know how much time goes into that, and I appreciate what you guys are doing. I do. Do you guys have any questions for me? Clark, no questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
Did you vote for the final budget?
No. For that very reason, this is, and my quote was actually, Charlie, this thing's going to be upside down before the ink is dry. And what happened in the last, when the original biennial budget was signed, it was literally a week later out of balance. And as long as we continue to do that, we're going to continue to see the special session be abused. We're going to continue to see this thing dragged out longer and longer and longer. And again, keep in mind, the general fund's growing by $2 billion, 7%. So we have to get those wants in line with the tax revenue that's coming in. And it's a very generous amount of tax revenue.
It's wants, not needs.
What's that?
Wants, not needs.
Well, obviously, you have your constitutional requirements like education, and that's a huge fight. Just to simply get that funded first, per Article 9 of the state constitution, can't get it done. And then you've got your pensions, and you've got other things that are required, and that's where the priority conversation comes in, and we have to wire that down tighter.
The bottom line on the liquor issue: what if you look at 100% of what we had last year? What do we look forward to this year?
Well, you're going to lose, you're going to lose that 70-30 excise tax split, for sure. And I don't know what the city's numbers are on that.
About 23,000.
Yeah. So you're going to lose that, and then again, the way the initiative was written, local governments still receive the same liquor profit distribution plus that $10 million.
That didn't change.
No, there was a threat to change that actually.
That's why I asked. Yeah, I remember that. It was a big deal. But
Jason, did the border town profit? Was that ever on the table?
You know what, Gary? That's a great question. And I actually asked our lead staffer, and I don't even think it was ever on the table, because I think Chief Haugen in Sumas, I spoke to the Sumas City Council, and he was all over the liquor profits. And so I did some looking. I don't think so, but I can definitely follow up. It didn't. It wasn't immune affected.
Yeah, I
don't believe.
Hear there was.
Right. Yep. There's unfortunately everybody's sort of scraping and sort of carnivorizing and trying to keep themselves whole. I'm not a fan of carnivorizing local government, because I've sat right where you sat, and Gary knows crafting the budget how these things go. So we'll continue to fight that fight. Bonnie, you don't have a question for me. You look like you're just loaded for...
I have a comment, though. I see a lot more gray hair.
Well, just wait until I turn around and walk out of here. You'll see something else. I hope that I've stopped right here. I don't know. I doubt it, though. So.
I can tell you have. When I was your age, that's
you.
How I looked in the
color. You know what's beautiful about our pattern, though, Gary? I don't know about you, but when I look in the mirror, I can still deny it because I can't see it. It's only when I hold that mirror up, so I sort of get to lie to myself and tell me I'm doing okay.
I didn't even know it.
See? I have five kids, and they have now chimed in. No respect. None. So.
Jason?
Yes?
In reading the newspapers and other things, it seems that we're having some problems funding education. Can you speak to that? I mean, is that a... going to become a major problem in the future?
Well, it's the education funding's actually grown over the last budget. It's actually grown. It's actually increased. The real conversation, and it was one of the first votes we took, and there's a lot of irony, and I'm not going to get partisan tonight, but Article 9 is pretty clear. It's paramount duty to the state. So what that translates into is everybody says, look, fund education first. One of the first votes that I took on the floor of the House was upon adoption of the House rules, we tried three different amendments, and one of them was to fund education first per Article 9. Shot down. There was a bill run this session, and that was last session. There was a bill run this session to do that very same thing again. Shot down, and didn't even make it out of committee. So there's a real pushback to funding education first, and sort of the slogan became, you know, fund education with the first dollar, not the last nickel, because when you do that, that's the outcome essentially. And so it's part of that. Not only is it part of the broader prioritization conversation, it's constitutional per Article 9. And then you get the Supreme Court involved, and now the Supreme Court saying, look, you guys aren't doing your job. You're not doing it. You're not. I don't think the court needs to get involved. I think it's pretty clear, and I think you fund education first per Article 9. But it will continue, yeah, to answer your question, it's definitely going to continue to be an issue, if not the issue.
Healthcare is going to become an issue, yep. And certainly transferring expenses to the state. Is that being addressed at all? What's going to happen if the cost is shifted to the states from the federal government? Is that going to...
It's going to be a huge cost shift, and it is going to be a huge financial impact to the states. It's funny, I was just speaking with somebody in Bellingham an hour ago, and we were talking about that, and I actually, in one of my committees, the insurance commissioner was in front of me, and he was describing the insured, the underinsured, and the uninsured, and how they were all going to be covered under the Affordable Care Act. And I'm just looking at the numbers, and I'm thinking about the numbers on the East Coast. And I said, Mr. Commissioner, who's paying for this? And how are we going to do this? And essentially, his answer was, well, the federal government is. And that's accurate on paper in that they are going to initially, like most federally funded programs, they're going to fund almost fully, I believe it's 97%, the implementation of this. And then as the calendar moves forward, their funding backs off and the states are left with a pretty significant portion of that. And you're talking about billions of dollars. And how that gets paid for is anyone's guess, and that's why I asked him. And his answer was, the federal government is. My reply is that government is virtually insolvent. We're $15 trillion in debt. We spend $1.5 trillion every year, more than we bring in. I need a better answer. So that's the answer I'm getting, Harry. The federal government is. In the short term.
Another item. I just got something in the mail from the Canadian government. They have increased their retirement age for all pensioners to 67. Is there any talk of dealing with state pensions and increasing the retirement age?
As far as state pensioners?
Yeah.
Well, the reform that I told you about earlier was the reform that we were able to eke out. And again, everybody knows that that's an issue. The state, depending, if you ask the state has about an $8 billion unfunded pension liability. If you ask the third party that did an independent study on it, they'll tell you it's $50 billion. So my comment is, well, let's say that the truth is somewhere in the middle. Let's assume $25 billion. How do you fix that? You don't fix that by increasing contributions. I mean, you're talking, you know, and what if we say it's $15 billion? You're talking $15 billion with a B. So these things, they have to be addressed. And again, I think the only equitable way to address pension reform is moving forward. Those contracts were made. Those promises were made. The legislature agreed. Everybody shook on it. And I think to go back in hindsight is disingenuous. But moving forward, it's got to be.
The government has done.
Moving forward. Okay,
they
yeah.
Said, yeah, they, you know, this is what we've agreed to is what we're going to agree to. But for future, we've got to start increasing the retirement age.
And keep in mind, there were a couple of proposals. There was one last year there are still attempts to underfund some of these pensions, to skip payments.
Yeah.
And it is, you are setting yourself up for a disaster to do that, no matter what. I just think sticking with those rates that the actuaries come up with, the rates that are agreed upon by the different boards and commissions, I think you got to hold to those, because I just don't know how, when you get behind to that level, I just don't know how you make that up. And then you've got real people with real lives who've worked their entire lives counting on this, and all of a sudden, it's in jeopardy.
Yeah, I heard in the radio on this afternoon that they said that Medicare will be broke in 5 years.
I saw a headline this afternoon that addressed Social Security, and it basically, I think, said what we all know intuitively, and that's it's worse than we thought it was. And it's important. I think it's important, Harry. And this is a. I'll just take 30 more seconds. It's important. When we talk about these deficits, and I use specific language, it's the difference between what the state wants to spend and what the state has to spend. In one of my committees, we saw a bill this year. This year, while the entire state of Washington is being told there's not enough money, we have to raise your taxes, a bill is being run that was dead set for the governor's signature. And at full implementation, it would have cost about $800 million, almost $1 billion. That's the kind of promise I'm talking about being made out into the future, when today we're telling people we just simply can't do it all. So that's where I think you make your money in balancing the budget and creating a sustainable budget, is stop promising what you cannot afford into the future. Get a hold of what you have, and then you can start that conversation. So,
you know, there's a sense that Social Security is in trouble because there are so many people out there drawing on, and that's not the case. It's in trouble because the federal government has used the resources of Social Security to do other things. If they had left them alone, there would have been plenty of money in Social Security savings too, with the state funding their pension plan. They haven't funded the pension plan in how many years?
Yeah.
6, 7, 8, 9 years they have not funded what they were supposed to in the pension plan. And then there's shouldn't be any surprise that they need $50 million because every year they ignore the fact that, as Jason said, their actuarial commitment is to fund it, and they don't.
And so when you combine those underfunds, especially in the early 2000s, when you combine those underfunds with the market tanking, it's disaster. It's disastrous. So yeah, I guess that's politics in general, right? We send you down there to do what you say you're going to do and keep your word, and that's really the bottom line. It's not that difficult. That is the conversation. So,
further questions?
Well, I guess the only solution is that you issue birth certificates with an expiration date.
That is definitely a moving forward only policy, right, Dennis?
And he just signed up.
Yeah, I feel really bad because I just got my Medicare card the other day.
Yeah. There you go.
I only got 5 years.
Dennis just put a drop dead date, no pun intended. Well, thank you very much. Hope you guys have a great meeting. And you guys definitely know where to find me.
Thank you. Okay.
Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm just going to acknowledge in the audience Mr. Myers, who looked like he was just getting back from the Alps. Is that true? You, yes. You. From the Alps.
Switzerland. He's talking about your hat. And your
yodeling hat.
Okay, I guess the next is written communications. Do we have any?
We did receive a letter we received it on April 16th regarding the Gateway Pacific Terminal Project, which also included a booklet of support messages.
I saw those. Okay, that was well received. Okay, commission, committee, and board reports. Clark, do we have anything on the Blaine Economic Development Advisory Committee?
No report.
How about the Northwest Economic Council?
No report, but there's one.
So, good. Mr. Ockner is not here. Bonnie, how about the Blaine Chamber of Commerce?
No report.
How about the RED Loan Committee?
No report.
Paul, how about the WTA Board?
We had our monthly meeting on Thursday. Business proceeded as usual. Nothing of major importance, nothing of significance to blame.
Thank you. How about the Drayton Harbor Shellfish Advisory Committee?
No report.
Charlie. How about the Library Committee?
No report.
Dennis, how about the Senior Center Liaison Committee?
You got it. Liaison from Walt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Planning Department. Planning Commission, Mr. Jones.
No report from the Planning Commission, but I do have a report from the Park and Cemetery Board for you.
Thank you.
You were on a roll there. Sorry to break
you down. I was doing good.
So I just have a quick report for you on some of our ongoing park projects, in particular one that is in the works now. This is funded in part by a bond collected on the Homestead Drayton Reach project for some work that was left incomplete when they finished the project and then failed to execute as they moved forward. But also was funded in part by the operating and maintenance funds from the park and cemetery budget. So we appreciate that. I think some nice improvements here. These are down in the Montfort neighborhood, which is, as you know, in the south part of Central Blaine, on the west side of Peace Portal Drive. If you haven't been down to take a look at these, I encourage you to do that maybe next weekend. We are still in the process of building one segment of trail right now. And it should probably be done by the end of the day on Wednesday. The yellow portion that's in the dashed line here represents what was just newly constructed. There was also some maintenance work done on the trails in Montfort Park and then on that other segment of yellow trail that says existing trail. There was a trail in the corridor that we're working on, but it was a pretty rough trail. People were using it quite a bit, and in the foreground of this picture, there's actually a board laying across a real wet spot in the trail, and you had to get your feet pretty muddy to even get to that board. But the project has changed. Here's the project in the works earlier in the year, and a little bit moving forward. And then that's essentially the finished product on that segment of trail. You can see the crossing through the wetland area there, and then the trail and the hog fuel, it's called, which is like the bark and erosion control on the sides. That is our Washington Conservation Corps crew doing some wetland mitigation there on the side of the trail, because although trails are exempt as far as being able to cross through those areas, they still require mitigation. We planted quite a few, I forget the number, but 300 or 400 plants as part of the mitigation project. And there's a couple, another shot of the crew members working on another segment of trail, which connects actually to this area. And again, there was kind of a trail here before, but not like the one that we'll have when we're done. And there's the crew working just today. Yes?
Are they putting any barrier underneath these trails at all to keep the stuff from growing up through them?
Yeah, they put road fabric underneath the trail.
Because that was the problem down in Drayton Harbor, or down in the Montford Park one. Had a nice trail in there, but it just grew in on itself.
And that does happen. Even if you put the road fabric under, it still sort of happens, but you're right. You don't get as much coming up from underneath with the road fabric there. The road fabric is pretty expensive, but it's a, you know, you pay now or pay later kind of thing.
That's good. Thank you.
This is actually the crew that's there today. We switched crews during the middle here because of some reassignments, and they are working on a stair project that, as I mentioned, should probably be done by Wednesday, and that will finish the loop. One side of the trail, where it goes around the wetland and pond area, is sort of a more accessible trail, and then the other side is a narrower, more of a hiker trail that has actually some stairs in it. And there's the road fabric,
thank you.
As you mentioned.
My wife will
proof.
That.
I knew you were going to ask.
Yeah, my wife asked.
That's nice.
Yeah, but they pulled it up.
So that's a really great enhancement down in that area. We're pretty proud of it. The other things that are kind of in the works are up in Lincoln Park. We'll actually have the logging crew coming in tomorrow to take down some of the hazard trees, to remove a few trees that are in the line of the proposed sewer corridor, so that those can be removed now when they're marketable timber rather than basically given to the person who puts the sewer line through. And you'll also probably see some clearing on the south side of the park where a whole bunch of small alders have grown up. You used to be able to see from the field and from 8th Street up into the understory under the large trees. Used to be mowed and maintained, and that was before my time, but it's grown in with some alders in there. We're probably going to open that back up again. It was ironic that today someone stopped Alex and I when we were out there and said, so I heard you guys are going to be cutting down some trees, and we said, yes, we are, expecting, we didn't know what. And she said, is it possible that you could open this up like it used to be so you could see up into here? People would feel safer, and that is hopefully part of what is going to happen there. Our Conservation Corps crew will have a little bit of extra time while they're here. We're going to send them over to Semiahmoo to do some maintenance work on the Drayton Cove Trail. That's a responsibility primarily of the Semiahmoo Resort Association, but it is a public trail open to all. There are some brush clearing that we think we'll have some time for them to help out with. The Brickyard Park Playground is basically waiting to get through customs, and when it does, we will put it up. I think it comes from Germany. And that's why it is slightly delayed. But you might see if you go down there, there's a big area excavated out that will be filled in with the fall material and where the playground goes. You just have to visualize it at this point. And then down in Marine Park, a couple smaller things are happening. Boy Scout troop, a young man working on his Eagle Scout project, is putting in a railing around one of the old picnic shelter pads. And that railing is up. He's in the process of building picnic tables that will hopefully be done this coming Saturday. And we'll have a new little picnic area there that'll be out in the sun and not under a shelter, because the shelters are nice, but once in a while the sun shines and we want to be out in it. And then the other thing, we've planted a couple hundred more shoreline enhancement plants along the side of the trail. New pink tags. We used to have orange tags. Those are still there. The pink tags are the new plants. And we are going to be bringing in some beech logs to help with some habitat enhancement and some beech stabilization there. We hope, as part of the Lincoln Park project, some of those logs will find their way down to the beach. So lots going on, and I just wanted to let you know about that.
Mayor, I'd like to jump in just for just a second and
Mr. City Manager.
And tell you how much improvements we've seen in our park system since Michael and Alex took it over. It's been an incredible improvement. We actually do have a really nice park system now, and the work that we're doing with trails and some of the parks, it's pretty impressive. And living down where Charlie and I live, it just occurred to me a few weeks ago when I went around the neighborhood thinking, you know, this was really pretty cool in our neighborhood that we have these trails that hook up. And Michael and Alex and the Parks and Cemetery Board, who kind of provide some of the vision and support, I think are doing a wonderful job, and it's showing. And as Michael said, there's a bunch left to be done. It's only going to get better.
It's very noticeable. Yes, Clark.
I want to ask Michael a question. Michael, the Creighton Grove Trail, does that come from the state park there and then go around up below the houses up above?
It comes.
The old road, right?
It originates, from the county park, actually, that is. And it goes along on the old road grade, and then it zigzags up through Drayton Cove, or Drayton Hillside, too.
Thank you.
Next is Law and Justice Council. Chief, do we have anything that...
There has been no meeting, so I have no report, sir.
Thank you, sir. Small Cities Caucus, you attended a meeting. I can't remember the date, Gary, but it was a week ago. And I thought it was very, very informative. You might like to comment on it as well.
Yeah, there were several really good discussions that went on. We had a legislative update there as well, and there were some discussions about the EDI funding, and what the heck else did we get into?
Right, a little bit on the changes that occurred with the economic development.
Right.
With Peggy Zorro the two gentlemen from the port.
Right.
And we also had two gentlemen from Western Washington.
Oh, that's right.
University.
Yeah, there has been some major changes in the economic development arena. It's not surprising that Clark hasn't been to a Northwest Economic Development Council meeting, because it's just a totally different program now. The I don't know if this means anything, but the Center for Economic Vitality, which is attached to Western Washington University Business and Economics College, and where Tom Doerr worked and did good work at the CEV, that has now the mission of the CEV is now focused on exports, and they're not doing the business consulting work with small businesses. Tom left. He now works for Whitby Bank or in Mount Vernon or one of the or Burlington, one of the banks. The Small Business Development Center, which also is affiliated with Western Washington, is operated by Jennifer Shelton. The consultants that were working for the SEV have now moved down to Jennifer's shop at the SBDC, so we're still getting the same kind of coverage that we had before, but out of a different office. John, I forget his last name,
Mitchner
moved from the Economic Development, Northwest Economic Development Group to the Port of Bellingham. And he's working with Dodd Snodgrass under the tutelage, under the direction of Lydia Bennett, who now has been given economic development responsibilities at the port. And Peggy Zorro has moved into the Northwest Economic Development Group, and they are primarily a high-powered business board that kind of working at the political and somewhat policy end of economic development, but they're not actually going out and doing any direct work at this point in time. So it's a huge shakeup, and it's got to settle, needs to settle in a little bit. Everybody's trying to figure out how this is all going to work. But from my experience, it's not unusual. These things seem to happen a lot in the economic development business, and hopefully, I think Peggy's a great addition. Sorry to see Tom go. But I think John going to the port and working with Dodd is a real good move. I think the two of them can get a lot done. So anyway, it's a big shakeup. Yeah.
Need a roadmap.
Yeah, yeah.
Figure that one out. The next is the Washington Council of Governments. There was no meetings this month, so there's no report.
Is that, did the new director... Has he started yet?
I'm not sure. Not sure.
Did that all work out smoothly as far as
it went very
second
well.
Man Gordon Rogers, yeah, and all that?
Yeah. I believe it's gone very. I haven't had an opportunity to deal with them very much because they haven't had any meetings this month. So I'll learn more in May.
Okay.
Okay. City manager and staff reports. City manager.
All right. We'll start with. Public Works, and turn it over to Raven.
Evening. A few items to update you on. First, the bid schedule for Marine Drive. All the permits are now in hand for that project. We're finalizing the design. The Planning Commission approved the design to have an 8-foot sidewalk. That widening of the sidewalk on the north side of the street is going to involve some more retaining walls and a different hand railing on the sidewalk because we now have a steep drop-off. So they're anticipating that getting out to bid by May, which is just around the corner, and we hope to have a bid award from you at your first meeting in June. So that's at least our target at this point, and then we always have the second meeting if we need to fall back on that. Last meeting, you asked me for an update on the Vista Terrace ULID project. With the passage of the state budget, we've now been contacted by the Public Works Trust Fund folks, and they are expecting to send out a scope of work to us in the next 2 weeks. And that's what we use to generate a contract. So it's going to be our goal to turn that around as quickly as possible to have this finalized by the end of May, try to capture some of the 8th Street costs and also the Reichert EB design costs that we've already incurred as part of our match. So that is the current plan for that. Last meeting, Mr. Beck had asked you all to think about different stop signs in downtown and so forth. We've talked about that as the senior staff here, and we understand that stop signs and moving around things like stop signs and parking and so forth can kind of create a bit of unrest. Sometimes it can be an emotional topic. We're kind of concerned for pedestrian safety in removing stop signs on Peace Portal entirely. At the same time, there are some similar intersections on that route that don't have stop signs, but we're not necessarily recommending that you add them either because there really isn't a warranted need from an engineering perspective. It's really much more about what kind of pedestrian-friendly nature do you want that street to be. At this point, we also talked about the Martin Street as a through route instead of 3rd, and our thought is that Martin Street being a dead end, kind of the commercial corridor with angle parking, don't really recommend making that, not having a stop condition there. Anytime you're going to have vehicles backing into traffic, you kind of want to have some mechanisms around to slow people down. So that being said, I just wanted to acknowledge that anything that we do could have a domino effect. So if we decide to add more stop signs, that could create some unrest with folks that may decide then to use, this is going back to Peace Portal, sorry. If we go back to Peace Portal and add more stop signs, that might add more traffic to Third because people might get tired of stopping as they go north, things like that. So at this point, I guess we're recommending no change unless you would like us to make one. And if you do think that is something that you'd like us to explore, I'd recommend more process so that more people can have something to say about it.
Yes, Dennis?
Dennis, first. My comment with regard to the crosswalks, they're pretty dangerous in town. And to remove a stop sign would even make it, to me, it would be much worse. Do spend a little time walking on the street.
Charlie?
Question about where Ken Imus has tore up a sidewalk along the 450 Market was. What's going to happen there?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Ken Imus, the sidewalk in front of the old
450 Market's been tore up.
It. What's going to happen there? It'll be reopened, but we are working with Ken on guardrail similar to the other ones.
Is there any timeline or anything?
At this point, no. No, at this point, there isn't. But we really can't reopen it without something there.
Right.
And so there'll probably be a temporary measure, and then we're hoping to get something before 4th of July. That may mean the city taking action and putting them in. I think the city was responsible for the other ones in front of various vacant lots. But we're coordinating with Ken at this point on it.
So he has no plans to develop that piece anytime soon?
I can't speak for Ken and what his plans are. I don't have an application in my office to develop that.
Yeah, so we're going to have to put something up. I have another question for Raven. On the Vista Terrace, ULID, do you have any idea when that might take effect, specifically when the street lights will go up?
I don't. As we get moving ahead back into design and so forth, I'll do my best to update you when I can get it a little better nailed down.
Might it be by the end of summer?
That's certainly a good goal.
Could be. Okay. All right. Thanks.
One of the issues seemed to be with the stop signs is the rolling stops by Canadians who seem somewhat confused by stop signs.
Canadians.
I'm not sure what that's all about, but is there any way of notifying people that there's a stop sign coming up, or is that the issue, or is it just people who are not familiar with the town and maybe fail to see that the stop sign's fastly approaching them and they need to come to a stop?
I'm trying to think of a politically correct.
You have a blinking light.
Put a sign up there. Be careful.
Is it flashing lights? Is that the answer?
We have one.
Stop on the pavement. We hung yellow flags off the stop signs.
Yes.
There's a red flashing light on the stop sign. I don't know how much further we can go other than have Officer Landis get out of his car and stand in the intersection.
You know, though, we actually did look at this. And from the standpoint of, you know, maybe the maybe there should be a positive reward for stopping instead of a negative reward for not stopping. And so what we came up with was a plan where if somebody actually stops, the police officer runs out and gives them a coupon. And the coupon can be used to go purchase gasoline and get discounts on milk, eggs, and cheese. And that way we help our local businesses because, you know, they'll go to Joe's or someplace.
and buy gas, and then at the same time they get discounts on some of the dairy products that they seem to enjoy. So that's a positive thing rather than a negative thing. Instead of getting a ticket, they get a coupon.
You better wink at Jeremy. You better wink at Jeremy, or else he's going to take you at
Charlie has an idea that he wants to share with us.
Is it with the bumps on the road before the stop sign make people realize that they need to stop?
Those are pedestrians.
I see people running, one out by the windmill. I mean, driving bus, people run that because I don't think it's well enough marked that it's a stop. I mean, it looks like it isn't a stop, four-way stop.
I'd have to defer to Raven for traffic engineering, but that's actually something that Bill Bullock mentioned last week in regards to another intersection that we're working on. And you can do both the thermoplastic bumps, or you can actually burrow a channel in the roadway, and they both have the same aspect.
But it makes you think, makes you realize that you're going to have to do something.
You'd better put down the strips of spike strips. Raven, do you want to comment on that, or
just a question?
You know, we're talking about a very low speed road where there is pretty adequate visible markings. Mm-hmm. I guess I caution against using a whole lot more when you just get into a situation where, you know, you have to maintain those rumble strips or that thermoplastic, and they can actually get slick. You know, so if a car is slamming on their brakes and they happen to be on some thermoplastic, they're not going to have the same traction as they would on the road. The friction and so forth is kind of a... and I think the last thing we want would be them think that they hit something or drove over something, and we're paying more attention to that than to the pedestrian that we're trying to get them to cross. I don't know that that is the application that I would particularly recommend.
Dennis has a question. Is the parking space on the west side, as you come from the north, are those parking spaces blocking that?
If you have a big truck overextended.
The big white pickup that parks there every morning.
I mean, that in order to get across, if you walk on that crosswalk, you have to get out in the middle of the crosswalk to see whether anybody's coming and driving. Hmm. And I would imagine the same problem exists for people driving.
Take a look at that.
Mm-hmm. I think we need to paint something on the road in that at that intersection, something really eye-catching, so people want to stop and look at it.
Yeah, this,
I've seen some really neat Asian things painted on roads at intersections like that.
I agree. I think if you had one of those artists that do that, paint a big hole.
Seriously, something eye-catching. People would stop just to look at it.
Maybe signs in several different languages.
Let's put out a call for an artist to donate his time.
Correct. Dale said to me, he said, you just can't fix stupid. That's kind of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, that is good.
If there's no comment on that, but I'll be doing
it. If there's no other questions, Raven, are you?
That's all I have.
Thank you.
Okay, let's...
City Manager?
Michael, do you have anything? Michael Haslett.
Just a short update on Nexus. We've been working on the northbound Nexus lane on the truck route. WashDOT was set to go out to bid on Monday for lane demarcation and improvements to coincide with the new work done at the Canadian border. They had to delay that because of a couple of requests by our Canadian counterparts. They're working out exactly how the Nexus lane is going to flow. It actually had a request to make that northbound off-ramp up to D Street, make that a permanent route for the Nexus traffic, as opposed to just the temporary setting that, it has been. Both WashDOT and our office see some real issues with that, but just to make certain that everyone has a chance to come to the table, WashDOT has delayed their bid call on that project for a bit. And we do have a meeting, I believe, tomorrow afternoon with a couple of the businesses from down at the truck route itself who want to make sure that they have an opportunity to talk to WashDOT. And so we'll have that meeting tomorrow afternoon. There's a note in your agenda for IMTC. They had their monthly meeting in Blaine last week, and it was a very full agenda. A lot of topics speak regionally as opposed to locally. So, Raven, was there anything in particular that we should bring up? Other than that, it's a very good group, and they're doing an awful lot of work that affects us one way or another, both in terms of rail and in terms of the crossings. So, good people at the table.
It was a good networking meeting, and we are looking at trying to get some letters of support from WashDOT on some of the projects that we're considering applying for grant funds and so forth. So it's good for that kind of networking.
Is there any discussion about the Blaine train stop update?
It was before I got there.
I can't think of any.
I don't think so.
I don't think that was brought up on the agenda.
Okay.
They are continuing work on the pre-clearance and post-clearance of the train, so to speed the passage back and forth. And anything they do to speed up the travel at either end gives them a few extra minutes to perhaps use
to justify the stop.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's it, sir.
Okay. Michael Jones.
Yes, not a lot to report on the Banner Bank relocation, but we will keep that on the agenda because there will probably almost always be something. We're still working on the final plans. It takes a really long time to get from 80 or 90% done to 100% done on plans because things always come up. But we are working through this final decisions on some of the space planning. And some minor changes you'll notice if you happen to wander over there, like a mailbox system has been put up in the lobby and keys will be assigned to the various tenants and that kind of thing.
Mike, are the doors going to be powered like these out here?
The front door to the building?
Yeah.
It was not planned to be because we're not making any changes to the door. It could be. Those cost about $1,200 per door opener.
They aren't required, though.
They are not required. To the best of my knowledge, they're not required. The building was built to code when it was built, and everything that we affect or change, we need to bring up to code. Ed will certainly keep us on top of that.
Okay.
I think it's appreciate you bringing that up, because frankly, I had not thought of it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's any way that this
that's what I was thinking
stuff that we put on this door could be used
possibly
over there. Yeah. But it needs to be done. The budget on this is tight. Mm-hmm. And so it may have to be done, you know, outside of the money that we have to fix the building. We try to find it. But it has to be done. I mean, ultimately, you have to have that kind of access if we're going to be in that building.
And those doors are a little more free-swinging than these doors, and those doors open in and out there. I know these do as well, but it's fairly easy access. But I understand. I appreciate the difference.
Is the fact, Michael, that we have a court there, is that a requirement of a court that we have some public access?
No more than
City Hall.
Other offices.
The Americans with Disabilities Act requirements are, you know, across the board for all publicly accessible facilities. Mm-hmm. There are some different standards to different degrees, but again, the
what you're required to do is to bring things up to code when you affect them, when you change them. We're not making any changes to the door. It's not mandatory, but as Gary pointed out, it would be a really good thing for us to do. The budget is extremely tight. So that my answer at this point was what I said to Councilman Olson, is it is not in the plans at this point. One other item. I just had a question
about a few weeks ago there was a sign-up space available sign for lease available sign, and it was taken down.
It was because that temporary real estate sign was illegally located. It didn't comply with our sign code. So my office had the sign removed. We are currently working through a process with the city manager to place one in a manner that is consistent with our code.
Okay.
He didn't put it up, I just want to say, but you know, he's the one who has to apply for the request.
He is the chief real estate agent. The chief renter agent.
He is. He's at least responsible, well, I guess, for making sure it's full. So there's another sign, I'm sure, that's going up, but we're working through that.
And are we getting any nibbles on any tenants to fill up some of those spaces on the second floor?
It looks like we could likely have four tenants from the third floor move down.
Oh, okay.
And other than that, I'm not sure. Michael has shown it a couple of times. Brian has shown it a few times, but he hasn't said that he has anything else right now. We're looking at possibly going into the old immigration law offices and doing some remodeling to add more offices there. What are the three, Michael?
There are two offices, a conference room, and then a big open reception area.
And we could go to
six offices easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're looking, need to price that and see what the costs would be to do that. It appears that the market is for the single offices, primarily Canadian businesses. Mm-hmm. We have the Binghorn suite, they'll be vacant at the end of the week, and we could probably keep that as an office suite for a while to see if there's anyone that we that might be interested in that. But we thought we were going to lose the third floor tenants, but it looks like we extended them for another month, and it looks like they're going to stick around, maybe even with long-term leases as opposed to month-to-month.
That's good.
Any thought of having a city-owned liquor store inside the building?
City-owned liquor store. It would be hard to keep.
Since we're being a bit entrepreneurial, I thought maybe we might want to extend our entrepreneurial.
We have a hard enough time about being drunk all the time.
Just a thought, you know. Just keep thinking about these things that we can make.
Well, we could
make money on
the liquor profits, right?
That's right. I mean, we might as well be in the business.
Yeah.
Jeff, any thought of that? Neil?
That'd be legal.
We could bootleg a little.
Yeah.
Right. From Michael.
Sure.
Quick question: are those two ladies moving? Speaking of liquor store, are they moving over behind the steakhouse?
They did.
The existing liquor store, that Blaine Liquor Outlet, I think that's what it's called, is moving to the space on G Street in the behind the steakhouse. Yes.
They'll be open tomorrow.
And so is By the Bay Realty. And so I did have one other thing I wanted to report on. It's not on the agenda, just to mention briefly that Raven and I have been working together to work on coordinating development review a little more directly between the departments. So when people come in for permits, development applications, and we're working on a program where Ty McWilliams from Public Works and Alex Winger from my office will actually be doing coordinated review together in the same room rather than in two different offices and trying to touch base on that. They'll start hopefully in the beginning of May, spending a couple of afternoons working on that together simultaneously, and then we expect, if it works out, that we may have sort of a standing schedule where we don't know what it will be yet, but for example, it might be Tuesday and Thursday mornings or Monday and Wednesday afternoons. If someone, a developer or a member of the public, came to our counter, they would be able to talk to both Public Works and Building and Planning all at the same time, rather than have to be shuttled to another office when we run out of the information that they're looking for, which is typical now. Someone will go to Public Works, get their questions answered, and say, oh, that's a planning question. You need to head across town. And the same thing at planning. We get to a certain point and say, well, I think this is the case, but you need to go talk to Public Works. So we're working on trying to smooth that process a little bit.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes.
Excellent.
That's all I have.
Yep. Any other questions? City Manager?
Okay. Jeff?
Yeah. I've got the 2012 first quarter financial report to get. So we are into the one quarter end of the year, and so far general fund revenue and expenditures are showing stability with no major variations. But as you heard from Mr. Overstreet regarding the state budget, it's going to have an impact on local governments, and namely that's going to be the liquor excise tax. And AWC is going to put out a webinar, I believe tomorrow, getting in more into detail on those impacts. And I'm not quite sure if we'll see the impact in 2012 or if it will begin in 2013, but we can anticipate probably about a loss of, as I've said, about $23,000. And that could be over the next 2 years. So that's something to continue to monitor and keep a lookout for. This chart here shows our fund balance at the end of the first quarter. It is slightly below our target, about $215,000. And we also have our general fund reserve, which is about $300,000. So between the two, the fund reserve and the general fund balance, we have about $500,000 that we could use for that potential, that for sure loss, actually, in the liquor excise tax. And then looking at our general fund revenue actuals, we're at 25% of the total forecast, so that's good news, with most categories at or above their estimates. Looking specifically at sales tax revenue, it is 24% of the forecasted estimate, and so far that is looking good. That sales tax revenue is remaining stable. Cumulatively, first quarter is about 3% higher than the 2011 first quarter, and our January collections are about 8% higher than the 2011 collections. And so those January collections are reported in March because of the two-month lag. This chart here shows you the dramatic increase in retail sales. That is, over the last 2 years, retail trade has increased by 17%. And transport and warehousing is another one that has increased fairly dramatically, and that's by 23%. Whereas you can see construction in this chart, for the blue section there, construction has decreased by 28%, so really no surprises there. And then compared to 2011 first quarter, our actual general fund revenue is down less than 1%, so again, showing that stability. Turning to general fund expenditures, we're at 25% of the adopted budget, with most categories holding at or below their estimates. Looking at salaries and benefits, so far we are at 25%, so that's good there. And then comparing to prior year, 2011, we're about 1.66% up, or $19,000. And then looking at the utility funds, the electric fund, first quarter operating revenue is 31% of the forecasted estimate, and our operating expenses are tracking at 22% of appropriations, so that fund is still looking good, still remaining healthy. As we mentioned earlier in the year, we're going to continue to look at, you know, with BPA or wholesale rates, and when we reach into the tier 2 rate. So we're not there yet, but probably will be a matter of time before we
start to see the impact of that. Good news with water revenue. As you recall, the last couple of years, it's been fairly down. Now it's looking at, it's up. We're at 24% of our total forecasted. Our expenses are 23% of the budget. And then comparing to 2011, we're about 18% higher. So that's a good sign. And it seems to be that it's stabilizing at this point. Wastewater, we're at 25% of our estimated revenue. And our expenses are tracking at 15%. However, as you can see in on that chart there, the green spike, that's our when most of the wastewater debt is due in June. So what we're looking at is our cash flow, and to see continue to monitor our cash flow to make that payment. Looking at stormwater, no surprises there. We're 25% of our revenue, and 18% of our appropriations. Now looking at some of the other revenue sources, on our utility taxes, we're at 26% of what we estimated. On our gas, garbage, telephone, utility tax, we're about 22% of the current estimate. And of course, no surprises there, the 1 cent gas tax, still tracking at fairly high, about 30% of our total forecast. And we're about 32% higher compared to the last year. Our lodging tax is still down. We're about 14% of the total estimate, about 9% below the first quarter of 2011. But overall, our 2012 first quarter expenditures of all funds are at 24%. Of total
appropriations. Questions? I have a question. To go back to Raven, because he just mentioned stormwater, reminded me, how are we doing on this Birch Bay thing?
Oh,
anything happened?
Trying to think of my last report. I don't think anything has happened since my last report. We're still in correspondence with Department of Ecology. We're getting some maps and so forth prepared to elicit our response. And I know they have met with the county and they have met with resources, and we've asked in writing for them to provide us any written information that might get passed on to them. So.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? The reason that I was running around, it's my report. I forgot to print the major projects update. And so I had to run and do that. But I'm going to hand these out, take a look at them if you have questions later tonight or next meeting. But we have, we keep track of our major projects that we have ongoing in the city, and on a quarterly basis, kind of give you a very short update as to where these projects are. And so this is the first quarter, no, the end of, no, this isn't the end of the year, it's the first quarter update. I didn't change the title. On the various projects that that we have during this morning. Yes. And so take a look at it, and if you have any questions, you'll either ask us tonight or whenever, or you can give me a call and we can talk about it. But, lots, as you can see, a lot of things going on. Some of these projects are new, some of them are completed. The light blue colors are completed. We leave a lot of those on there to deceive you, so that you think that you know we're actually very productive.
Doing something?
Yeah. Okay. Any questions on that?
the meters, number eight.
Number eight.
Are some of those been installed?
Yeah, I believe we're about 25% installed.
Any problems with them?
No, we're doing really well. Other than the crews might like to do something different on some days.
The guys, when they came to my house and wiped off all my computers and everything, they were very nice about it.
Were they?
Yes.
Did they give you a little hanger? Okay.
They were really nice. No, I was there.
We've had pretty good cooperation from people, and so far the feedback has been positive. So we'll see
how. Must be a month or so ago, some comments from on the Canadian station that they had problems with meters reading too high and they had to take them back and recalibrate.
You may have some folks complaining about, you know, whether or not their rates may have been affected or anything like that, and it's because the new meters aren't functioning properly and the old meters, as they get older, slow down.
I don't know whether it was the same provider.
So could be. Okay.
Yeah.
No, we haven't had any problems like that.
I forgot to ask Sherry if she had anything. Okay. Just ask you to take a look at the calendar for the upcoming meetings that that we have over the next, I guess, to the end of May. And if there are no other questions, Mayor, that concludes staff reports.
Thank you, Gary. Next item is the consent agenda. Approval of payables, $160,368.76, and the council, city council minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Passes 6-0. Next item is the council action items. First item is the Peace Portal Trail Bid Award. Raymond, is that yours?
That would be mine. So the bids were opened last Friday, and I should count them before I tell you. We received 6 bids. One bid was determined not to be responsive, so they did not submit a bid bond. The lowest responsive and responsible bid was Faber Construction. Their bid was $220,789. Which was, in our fund, a fair bid and is worthy of getting the contract. One thing I wanted to note, since the time of this council request for action, we've been notified by the Transportation Improvement Board that they would give us an additional $16,355. And that's because costs have gone up since our original estimate, and they allow a certain percentage for that. In addition, your staff's recommendation that the council accept these bids by Faber Construction indicates subject to WSDOT approval, and that's because of the WSDOT funding. We received that approval by email today.
Terrific.
So that all being said, and in hopes that we'll be able to start this project in mid-May, we request your approval for award.
Anyone would like to make a motion to approve the?
I move that we accept the bid from the Faber.
All seconds. Any questions or comments? Call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Next item on the agenda is an ordinance 12-2812, amending chapter 17.86, flood hazard. Michael, I believe that's yours, is it?
That is mine. I have a report for you on that. This would be a code amendment for our flood hazard regulations. It's a zoning text amendment. It's a type 2 city council application, meaning that it comes to city council for a final decision. The Planning Commission recommends approval on this, and you do have their recommendation in the ordinance that's presented. But to give a little bit of background on this, the National Flood Insurance Program has been around for a long time. It was adopted in 1968 by Congress, and basically it established federally backed flood insurance for people who live in flood hazard areas. And it required that local jurisdictions, counties and cities, participate in the program through the development of flood hazard regulations. So if you had flood hazard regulations, your property owners could be eligible for the federally backed insurance. In 1972, Hurricane Agnes rode up the East Coast, and Congress became very aware that the program they put in place a few years before wasn't having very positive effects because hardly anyone was participating. So in 1973, they essentially mandated participation by communities by making eligibility for most federal disaster relief only. The communities would only be eligible if they were participating. And then in 1979, FEMA was established, and FEMA now manages the National Flood Insurance Program. So what we do is we work through FEMA on these, and we coordinate with them. So our flood hazard regulations are essentially the rules for building in the floodplain. The rules for adjusting land or filling, clearing land in the floodplain as well. And for Blaine, it's a very limited geographical area that is included. In some cities, it's massive. In some places, the whole community is in the floodplain. But in Blaine, it's a fairly limited area. Those are codified now in Municipal Code Section 1786. So this is an amendment, not a brand new code section. Our flood hazard areas that we have are what are called Zone AE and Zone VE. There are two different areas where studies have determined what the highest flood level is expected to be. One of them is from wave-generated flooding, and the other is actually very similar. Really, in our instance, they're almost all wave or tidal-generated flooding. But they are two different elevation levels depending upon where the waves are coming from or where the fetch is. We have those in the Wharf District, Semiahmoo Spit, and then along the shoreline fringe. The areas that are crosshatched here in blue are the areas in the Wharf District that are within our floodplain, if you will, or our flood hazard area. You can see most of that is Marine Park and then Wharf properties. In particular, the area that's designated for future Plover Park is one of the bigger areas, and some of the other port development property. And there's a zoom in on that one section, and then a close up there of the area towards the end of the wharf. Out switching over to Semiahmoo Spit, you can see the shoreline fringe area. You can see the front of the backside of the hotel, Beachwalker condos. Those areas are in the flood hazard area as well. And then some of the improvements down near the park, including part of our old wastewater treatment plant. And then you can also see the shoreline fringe area designated as it being in the floodplain. And that continues. You go all the way around all of Drayton Harbor. There is a margin there. The base flood elevation for most of that area is 8 feet above mean high tide above mean sea level, excuse me. And so it doesn't mean 8 feet up from the very highest mark you can find for the water, but where sea level is established, which is in between the highs and lows and all of the whole tidal set. So that's where the flood hazard regulations apply in Blaine. And that's a little background on where they come from. But there's another factor that comes into play in what brings this before you tonight, and that's the Endangered Species Act. In 1973, the Endangered Species Act was passed by Congress to protect endangered species, and specifically to avoid take, in other words, the killing or something that results in the death of an endangered species, either directly or indirectly. The National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS, is a division of the of NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Aeronautical Administration, and they are responsible for stewarding marine life and being the stewards of fish and marine mammals and other things like that that are regulated under the Endangered Species Act. So what happened was several years ago, it was determined by NMFS that FEMA was not complying with the Endangered Species Act in the way that they were regulating the National Flood Insurance Program. So they were essentially regulating in a manner that was the result was resulting in danger to endangered species. It was resulting in the deaths of endangered species and was likely to lead to the potential extinction of some. In particular, in our area, that was related to threatened and endangered salmon species, steelhead, and the resident orca pod in the southern part of Puget Sound. And so FEMA was ordered to comply with the Endangered Species Act. And FEMA presented then three options to the communities that are involved in the program. And those were to adopt either the FEMA model ordinance, to modify the existing local community code, for us it's that section 1786, or to require an Endangered Species Act compliance review on each project, which is a very, would, in my opinion, a very burdensome approach, which is very detailed review of every action someone wants to take. This Planning Commission staff presented our proposed option two to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission recommends that to you. Whether you know, the FEMA is requiring our compliance with the Endangered Species Act, but it is important to note that we are required to comply with the Endangered Species Act. FEMA doesn't need to make us do it. Everyone in the United States is required to do it because it's a federal law, and every individual is required to comply with the Endangered Species Act as well. So what are the impacts of these changes here? It will be an increased protection of habitat, an increased protection of people and structures, because there are some changes in our flood regulations, like elevating structures and things like that, that are a little more stringent than they were before. And, of course, obviously, the protection of the property and the structures. There's a lot of overlap with these regulations in Washington, with the critical areas regulations. We already do a lot of the things that were required by the model ordinance. That's one of the reasons I didn't recommend that we go with the model ordinance, because we already do a lot of these things. There's a lot of overlap with the shoreline regulations in Washington State and these FEMA regulations. Keep in mind that FEMA presented this as an overall model and wasn't looking at each city's individual regulations. So there will be, however, a moderate impact on development. There are some additional requirements here that aren't required through the Critical Areas Act or through the shoreline regulations, but they're not really very significant in the big scheme of things when you consider the development in the floodplain, and again, when you consider how limited of an area that affects in Blaine. The Planning Commission recommends approval of what's proposed. FEMA has sent a conditional approval letter, which is in your packet. They would approve of this as complying with their standards and would allow us to continue to participate in the National Flood Insurance Program if we pass the ordinance that's before you. I think this is the least impactful way of the three options that we can comply with FEMA's request and be in compliance with the Endangered Species Act in our floodplain development. And based on that, I staff also recommends that you accept the Planning Commission recommendation and approve Ordinance 12-2812.
Dennis, do you want to wait until there's a motion on the, yeah, on the floor? Anyone like to make a motion and waive the second reading?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, questions. Dennis?
Michael, is the treatment plant considered a critical facility?
The treatment plant could certainly be considered a critical facility, yes.
I didn't notice it was. It wasn't listed in the...
Listed where?
Oh, now you got me.
Well, it, in the definitions, unless it's somewhere else, the critical facilities are discussed in certain areas, but in the definitions it says critical facility means a facility for which even a slight chance of flooding might be too great. Critical facilities include, but are not limited to, and that's the key phrase there, okay. I think, schools, nursing homes, hospitals, police, fire, and emergency response installations which produce, use, or store hazardous materials or hazardous waste. I think there's some opportunity there for interpretation, but it is, in a lot of ways, I think we would consider it a critical facility for these regulations. It would guide me to review it and determine that.
Paul, you have a question?
Yeah, I'm having trouble getting my arms around this. Could you give me one, two, or maybe three of the most significant changes that are presented?
Yes, if you are adjusting habitat, taking some existing habitat in the floodplain or in the flood hazard area, and you are modifying it like you have a forested area and you're clearing it, you would need to comply with the regulations, which would very, very significantly limit that ability to clear that forested area, or you would need to prepare a report that demonstrates that you are not having, your action is not likely to result in take of an endangered species, and that's a new requirement.
Okay.
So, for instance, like on the port property, they don't have any forested land, but if down there they did, or if the park out on Semiahmoo Spit wanted to pave the beach and put in a boardwalk and change it dramatically, they would need to prepare that report. And honestly, they wouldn't be able to pave the beach. That would have too significant of an impact on, I would guess that would have too potential of an impact on species. One more thing before you ask the other question. It also requires, right now, we require that buildings be built at the base flood elevation or above. The general standard in most places is 1 foot above the base flood elevation, so you have 1 foot of freeboard. We're changing our regulations so there's 1 foot of freeboard, so that you have a little bit more of a margin change. Those are the biggest differences.
Okay. So clearing trees in the area right by the ocean, that's going to change significantly, be harder to do that?
It will be harder to do. It is already difficult to do because of critical areas regulations and shoreline regulations, but it will be harder to do only if it's in the flood hazard area. And remember, that only reaches about 6 feet or 5 feet up the bank in most places.
But the shoreline goes quite a bit.
Shoreline regulations go 200 feet inland.
Yes. Okay.
So that's what I mean. There's a lot of overlap. This doesn't really have a big impact on us as it might in some other communities.
Thank you.
Paul?
Michael?
A little second. Dennis has a question.
Okay, Dennis. I didn't see you, Dennis.
There's something then that triggers the requirement for this floodplain development permit?
Yes. What is considered development under this process, which is defined. So you come in to do something, you come in to build something, and you need a floodplain development permit.
Okay.
Second question. What's the relationship between this and vesting?
Well, you vest at the time that you have a complete application. So if someone were to come in with a new application after this is in effect, they would be under the new regulations. If they came in before this was in effect, they would be under the old regulations. There are provisions in the flood insurance program and in this code for pre-existing structures. So those are handled differently. They're not really considered vested because they exist rather than are proposed. A vested thing is something that is, from my frame of mind, it's a permit that's in the works.
Okay, so are there any existing buildings that will be affected by this?
There are. They're pretty limited. One of them is one of the buildings at the wastewater treatment site, the old wastewater treatment site, where Raven is having some work done, but where they're putting in some pumping facilities and things like that. That is within the floodplain, and that building was required to comply with the prior floodplain regulations, and it's vested under those. And then, like I mentioned, some of the other facilities, like parts of the hotel and some of those other buildings on that fringe of the Spit are subject to the regulations, as are buildings that exist on the some of the port's property, particularly out at that industrial area. That's kind of like a square near the end of Marine Drive.
So Would the proposed marina expansion be covered?
Well,
it's already flooded.
Right. So technically, yes, it's in the flood hazard area,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think that any of the I'm not sure how it would be covered by this, because that's very unusual. It's already flooded, and that was actually a lengthy conversation I had with some of the folks from FEMA when we were going through this. I was trying to explain that the vast majority of what they show as floodplain in Blaine is flooded twice a day, every day, under most, in some instances, several feet of water, because they've mapped the tide flats as flood areas. So they look at our maps and say, you have lots of floodplain, what do you mean? And I said, no, you guys got to look again. Most of that goes underwater twice a day. So it's a little different.
Michael, the insurance in it, people could apply for would be met, they'd be able to meet the requirements now if these conditions are put in place, as far as FEMA is concerned.
They will continue to be eligible for insurance, and we will not lose our community-wide eligibility if these are adopted. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
In other words, we're making this possible for those people that are in those areas to be able to get insurance.
Yeah, to be able to have flood insurance or to continue to have flood insurance.
If for whatever reason a tsunami occurs, they would still be covered if they had the insurance.
I doubt it, and I'm not an insurance agent to be able to talk about what their coverage is. I don't believe that insurance, though, covers a tsunami. That's not a normal flood. That's a different act. That's really an insurance question, totally out of my purview. I don't know what their insurance covers or doesn't cover.
Michael, a couple of situations currently on my mind. One is the Marin Hotel or Marin Apartments.
Yes.
Is that covered? Is that going to be included in this floodplain?
The floodplain exists with or without this ordinance.
Okay.
So we're not making a flood hazard area. It exists, whether we like it or not. It is where it is. It's mapped by FEMA, and it's been determined. And it's on that picture right up there. And the scroll button.
This is the completed Marin building.
Yeah.
And this one is that partially isn't completed building. Yeah. And this is the foundation of the
very, very incomplete building.
Yeah.
And you can see the line goes right through it.
Now, when we regulate these, we are able to do two things. First of all, we look at the maps. And secondly, we use local information and local knowledge. So if we have elevation data that demonstrates that is actually the map, the line is in the wrong place because we know what the elevation is, it's 14 feet. When you can move the line a little bit, and we have to demonstrate where that information came from and how that decision was made. And then when FEMA comes in, they'll ask us, why did you let that building be built there without doing this or doing that? And we'll say, well, because the elevation, your map is good, but your map's not as good as real data and real elevation information that is locally generated. So we have that option. But it's very likely that that building was required to comply. I don't know specifically. I'd have to go back and look.
Yeah.
But it probably is floodproofed to that elevation. And that's not really all that hard to do because the majority of that is well above. You can see it's right on the edge.
Yeah. There was some underground parking.
And parking's allowed to flood, but you can't have things like electrical facilities that are low enough in that garage that they would flood. You can have them in the garage, but they have to be high enough that they're above the base flood elevation. So it doesn't mean you can't build something. It just stipulates how you do it.
Okay.
And now it tries to avoid it as well. Yeah. It tries to completely avoid it, but that's not always possible.
Now, what would happen if an expansion of the existing marina would take place?
Don't know. That was sort of a similar question to Councilman Greeno's. I would really need to look at this and think about it. I've never encountered and been through a process where something floating, something already on water, was being regulated through the floodplain regulations. It's an odd circumstance. It's usually things that are dry and then get flooded, right? Rather than things that sit in water all the time.
It would probably need to be designed so that it would not be inundated during a flood. And by the nature of floating things, they're going to not be inundated during a flood. When the water gets 10 feet deeper, they're going to get 10 feet taller. You know, so I don't know, but it's a very unusual circumstance. It is possible that the test of not resulting in a take could be troubling for that development, but I don't know. I'd have to look at that.
Okay, thank you. Any other further questions?
Call for the question.
Okay, the question has been called. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Next item on the agenda is Resolution 1605-12, amending the 2013 Unified Fee Schedule for GFFSs.
Yes, we've now made that a word.
Okay.
So bringing this forward to you as what we understood or what we represent what we feel that you asked us to do at our last meeting, where a majority of you supported bringing this resolution forward. The resolution is fairly simple, but we essentially looked at the 2009 resolution and only modified what changed. So the intent was to note that the intended growth incentive was not as effective as we anticipated, kind of reestablish the priority to keep our utility rates reasonable to our existing and proposed prospective ratepayers, looking at our debt burden, and we saw some of that with Jeff's presentation today, and wanting to make sure that we're looking into that for the future. And also looking ahead at how to implement this, we decided just among staff that your intention was most likely to start where we left off. So in other words, don't take 2009 and bump it up to 2012, but start with 2009. So we're referring to the existing structure within the unified fee schedule for future increases, where we already have a basis with other city fees. So for all of those reasons, we're bringing you this resolution. I wanted to confirm that we have contacted our rate consultant, and confirm that the rates can remain under $100 a month if this is implemented on January 1st, 2013. The caveat to that being that the rate stabilization account that we're going to be using in 2012, also the other half of that would be used in 2013. I do have one friendly amendment to make to the resolution itself. The line that is the second whereas, we would like to add the word customer before our rate base. So the second whereas would read, the intended growth incentive has not been as effective as anticipated and accordingly has not provided the reciprocal increase to our customer rate base. Okay. And with that, turn it over to you for discussion and hopefully approval.
Would anyone like to make a motion and approve the second reading? Reading?
I so move.
Charlie makes the motion. Second. And Clark seconds. Any questions, comments?
Just one. The water, if you're out of city, you pay more. Is that correct?
Yes. That's correct.
And the sewer, that fee is the same whether you're inside the city limits or outside.
I don't know the history to that. Maybe one of my other department heads would, but this is the rates were mirroring 2009. So That's what we had in 2009.
No, it should be higher for outside city units.
Well, I show in 2009 we retained the wastewater fee at a reduced amount for outside city limits. It showed current fee being the same.
Yeah, that's.
So we'll look at that.
Understand.
Do you have the paper in front of you, Jeff?
I've got the current schedule.
I don't know. Do we have any outside reports?
Well, we're going to have.
No, those won't. Those
this is from the 2009. So it looks like that's been going up, but it showed the current fees all being the same.
It should be 100%. Just for the principal.
We're going to have to look at that, Dennis. I'm not sure exactly what we did there.
Do we want to table this or
no?
Pass it with it then.
What do you think?
It's not going to make any difference to me.
Pass it with amendment for that at 150%.
Yeah. Doesn't mean either.
Yeah. Typically, we would do 150%.
Right, that's what I thought.
Yeah. That's what it is.
Can we amend that to read that?
I think the other, not to jump ahead of you, Charlie, but you could amend it to go to the 150%, which is consistent with what we've done with other utilities outside the city. It was brought to my attention, someone asked me if there was going to be a public hearing on this. And I'm not recommending it, but I would be amiss if we didn't touch that base, because it's fairly typical that on revenue fee kinds of issues that we would have a public hearing.
Huh? Or at least have two readings.
Or two readings, yeah. But again, I just point that out so that you consider it. Not necessarily recommending it. This has had a lot of discussion.
But I want to request that we do.
Why was nobody at our meeting when the discussions about this and advertised?
Well, it's a little different than when you set a special hearing for something that people don't. Doesn't catch their notice so much, but I really think we should. If someone wants to build a hotel downtown with 50 rooms, they're going to have to pay $5,800 per room, correct?
Per ERU. I don't know what
which
a hotel
is,
room is.
Would be per 50, hotel.
A hotel room is 50% of an ERU, so it would be half.
It would be half that for each hotel room. I just think we at least, because we made a verbal commitment, I think we need to have a public hearing on this.
Question, was there a public hearing at the time that the fees were dropped to zero?
I think so.
No, there was not.
No.
There wasn't?
It was proposed and done in one meeting.
Okay. Yes. We have a motion on the floor, and I understand that motion waives the second reading. Am I correct, Sherry?
Actually, with resolutions, you're not required to have a second reading.
Okay. So we have a resolution with no requirement for second reading. Bonnie's proposing, I suspect, that we withdraw the resolution and recommending that we have a public hearing. I assume, am I correct, Mr. City Manager, that to withdraw the resolution, Charlie would have to withdraw it, and it would have to be approved by the seconder? Is that how that's done?
If they
wanted to withdraw.
Right.
We would have to withdraw it to hold a public hearing.
Right. You would have to, or you could, that would be the best way to do it.
Okay. Charlie, would you? Charlie, it's up to you. And then Paul.
I mean, it goes against my grain doing this. I don't want to hold a public hearing and just have the same crap we went through when we were trying to talk about it. So.
I am reluctant to withdraw my second for the following reason. There's a second procedural way we can accomplish what Bonnie is asking for, and that is to merely vote up or down on the resolution. And if four of us want to have a public hearing, we will vote this resolution down and proceed to a public hearing. If four of us do not want to have the public hearing, we will vote this resolution up. Godspeed.
Okay. Does anyone want to call for the vote?
Sure.
Okay. All those in favor, maybe we should do this electronically.
Are you ready?
Charlie can't do it. Charlie's is always on the floor. What happened, Charlie?
Whoops. Press it once.
You okay, Charlie? Okay, good. It hadn't been used in a while, has it?
Okay, that's it.
Okay, let's have the vote.
That was the safest.
You ready, Charlie?
Yeah.
Okay, if Charlie's not working, let's go to a hand vote then. Okay, all in favor, raise your hand. In favor, put your hand up. Opposed. Is it four to two?
No. Five to one.
Okay. Motion carries 5-1.
So for clarification, the rates outside the city limits, we will adjust to 150%. Is that what?
Yeah, it's already in the ordinance.
Oh, okay.
The ordinance.
Okay.
City code.
Thank you. Okay, the next item on the agenda is Resolution 1606-12, the Emergency Pump Repair Well 5.1. Raven, is that you?
That would be me again. Boy, busy writing these things last week. So this is a situation, I think the key word is emergency, where our best producing well, the pump shut down in mid-February. Manufacturer pulled the motor out, and it was our hope until last week that they were going to be able to repair it and put it back. And as it turns out, it was determined not to be repairable. So the main issue here for us is the timing. To go with a different manufacturer or a different supplier, we do not have the time to generate documents to put out a bid. In light of the fact that we're starting to get into season where we're going to have people watering more, as well as the fact that we now have construction started on our reservoir, the lining project that you awarded last time. So it's just kind of unfortunately, the situation where we don't feel that we had to go through a different process, and we bring this to you. Fortunately, it's not a lot of money. We feel that the price is fair, but it's not something that we were able to get competitive bids for.
Paul?
Okay.
Well,
I agree with you in principle. I ask simply, what's the possibility this would trigger an audit finding?
By declaring this emergency, you are following the laws of the state of Washington.
So there is no chance whatsoever?
That's right.
Thank you.
Any other further questions? Anyone like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion that we approve 1606-12.
Second it. Any further discussion, questions?
And waive the second reading?
I don't think we need
a resolution. That's right. This is a resolution.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, call for the vote. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Is there any unfinished business? Any council new business? Then we're going to go into executive session. And will there be any chance of a vote on this?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. And so we would like to clear the hall.
For how long will you be in the executive session?
15 minutes.